So I'd like to do two things to start off with. The first is to acknowledge my co-authors, John Schmidt, Dennis Tweeten, and Ruth Okamoto. And the second thing is to really thank Ingolf and the rest of the organizing committee for putting this on. It's already been a tremendous experience, and I know it took a lot of work to do it. I really thank them for being generous with their time and their facilities. So I'm going to talk about anisotropy, and I want to emphasize that I'm coming at this as a researcher into traumatic brain injury. So I'm talking not in terms of developing really a clinical technique, but to help people develop models like this. This is a model by Svein Kliven's group. This is a model from Songhai Ji's group at Worcester Polytech. And the idea is that modeling traumatic brain injury is going to be the answer for developing ways to prevent or even understand the disease to treat it better. To make models that are useful, they have to be trustable. And to be able to trust them, you have to know what's the loading, what are the boundary conditions, what are the interfaces and connections, what's the tissue mechanical behavior, and also to provide data for validation. One of the things our group developed very early on was a way to look at brain motion using MR tagging. So this is a human subject voluntarily performing head motion. This is head motion that's a fraction, maybe 20% of the amount of acceleration that a soccer player would experience when they're heading a soccer ball, which we've measured. And one of the things I would point out is tissue is obviously very elastic. If you see here after it decelerates, it's elastically deforming and then recovering back into its original position. And of course, the oscillations are decaying because it's viscoelastic. It's got energy dissipation as well as energy storage in it. So this is the problem we're trying to understand and simulate. And we believe, or at least it's very plausible, that brain tissue is mechanically anisotropic. If it is, then we want to be able to model that. So it's clear, this is a diffusion tensor image of a ferret brain, but the human brain is similar. It's clear that white matter in the brain is structurally anisotropic. It's got preferred directions of diffusion, for example. And the question is it mechanically anisotropic? The proposed model that we would start with first, which is the simplest model after isotropy, is transverse isotropy, which is the behavior you'd expect from a material with one fiber family reinforcing the material. In such a tissue you'd expect two different Young's moduli, which are the relationship between tensile strain and tensile stress, and two different shear moduli in general, mu1 and mu2, referring to shear in the planes that contain the fibers and shear in the planes that are normal to the fibers. And in addition to that, there could be a bulk modulus containing five parameters. So these aren't the only five parameters you could use, but there are five independent parameters that describe a transversely isotropic tissue in general. A standard engineering textbook would give you this description of a transversely isotropic material in terms of the Young's moduli, the shear moduli, and some Poisson's ratios. So this is called a compliance matrix. It's actually a shorthand for a compliance tensor, which relates, again, strain to stress. And this description assumes an axis of symmetry along the x direction. So I'm going to propose an alternative description, an alternative set of parameters in terms of a shear modulus, a baseline shear modulus, a bulk modulus, a shear anisotropy ratio, and a tensile anisotropy ratio. And this is what the compliance tensor would look like. And I don't want you to look at each term by term, but to just point out that the bulk modulus shows up in all the terms in this upper 3x3 subpart. It doesn't show up in the shear modulus terms. Here's the minimal shear modulus. Here's the maximum shear modulus. These are the upper 3x3, and the bulk modulus shows up in these terms. Okay. If you take the limit of an incompressible material, the term with the bulk modulus vanishes, and we get a much simpler compliance matrix. Okay, again, you can see that these terms depend on the tensile anisotropy ratio and the baseline shear modulus, okay, but no bulk modulus. Here, of course, the shear moduli depend on either the baseline shear modulus and the shear modulus and the shear anisotropy ratio. Okay. In contrast, if I were to look at the stiffness matrix, it becomes a much harder problem because the bulk modulus, the effects of the bulk modulus never go away. The bulk modulus is every term of the stiffness matrix that relates the strain to the stress. So I guess the first point, or the first argument I want to make, is that we want to think in terms of the components of the compliance matrix, and I particularly want to think in terms of three parameters: the shear modulus, the relative difference in Young's moduli, and the relative difference in shear moduli that characterize an incompressible transversely isotropic material. So how do plane waves travel in a transversely isotropic material? I want to talk mostly about polarization and propagation. So here's a longitudinal wave in a transversely isotropic material. Again, the fiber direction is in the x direction, essentially left to right. And the propagation direction is the direction the waves are traveling. And the polarization direction, the direction of the actual displacements, is in the same direction. That's the definition of a longitudinal wave. Here's a shear wave. The propagation direction is left to right. The polarization, though, is perpendicular. And it's in the plane that contains the fibers. Here's an alternative scenario. Propagation is in this direction. Polarization is also vertical. And here's one situation with arbitrary propagation and polarization directions. So it's important to know, to think about different propagation and polarization direction scenarios. Again, this is the scenario I was talking about. The propagation direction I'm going to denote by N, and the polarization direction by M in green. Okay, so those are the three different cases I showed before. So to find the wave speeds in different directions, the standard technique is to look at, first of all, simple plane waves, which can be described by this expression right here. They're complex exponentials in space and time. The polarization direction, again, is the direction of the actual displacements, M. If you substitute that into the equation of motion, okay, this is the momentum equation, basically the divergence of stress that gives you the acceleration. Substitute in the general expression for your material, a constitutive elastic constitutive relationship, you get an eigenvalue problem, which, if you solve it, gives you two shear wave speeds in transversely isotropic materials, and both shear wave speeds depend on the direction of propagation relative to the fiber direction. So here's one direction, okay, direction N. It's an angle theta relative to the fibers. Depending on the polarization, you can have waves propagating in that direction with two different speeds, okay? And you can change that angle, and your speed will change as well. So the point is that propagation direction in a transversely isotropic material depends on three parameters: baseline shear modulus, relative difference in shear moduli, relative difference in tensile moduli. In addition, it depends on the angle between the propagation direction and the fiber direction. Okay. So I'm going to show you some simulation results that demonstrate this. This is a cube of material simulated in a finite element model. The fibers are at 45 degrees. The propagation direction is downward because I excite at the top. But if I excite it in two different directions, I'm going to get two different wave speeds, even though the propagation direction, again, is the same angle relative to the fiber direction. If I excite in this direction, which is, I guess, the x direction, I'm going to excite fast shear waves, which have a longer wavelength than if I excite perpendicular to the plane containing the fibers, which will give me slow or shorter wavelength shear waves. Okay. If I have enough of these experiments, okay, I can outline an inversion approach that takes the apparent shear modulus, which is the density times the wave speed squared, computes an apparent shear modulus for each of these scenarios. In each of these equations, the unknown parameter that I'm trying to estimate is in red, and the known parameter that I'll measure is in black. If I only have one measurement, okay, for example, I know an apparent slow shear wave speed and an apparent fast shear wave speed at one location, I have an undetermined problem because I've got two data and three unknowns. However, if I accumulate measurements, I can assemble these equations in multiple rows of a matrix and solve in a least square sense for the unknown parameters. So here's just an array of experiments that were performed in simulations with different excitation directions, different propagation directions, exciting either a fast or a slow wave at a time. And generally speaking, the simulations do what they should. They're consistent with the theory, as they should be. So when I excite fast shear waves, this is the theoretical wave speed. Here's what I observe. It's very close. If I excite slow shear waves, we appear to have a shear modulus close to the slow shear wave speed. And in this numerical experiment, I do essentially 8 numerical experiments and come up with, for all the same sets of parameters, and come up with estimates of my 3 parameters, which are very close to what they're supposed to be. So you give it ideal data, you'll get close to ideal results. But the point is, to estimate all 3 of these parameters with confidence, we need to have multiple sets of experimental data with different propagation and polarization directions and at different angles. So here's some actual experiments where we look at tissue that we believe to be anisotropic, and specifically we believe to be transversely isotropic, which is a piece of muscle tissue with a dominant fiber direction along the direction of this arrow, and we excite it centrally with a piezoelectric actuator. We've also done experiments in cubes of tissue where the fiber direction is known. And we perform these experiments in a 4.7 Tesla scanner at WashU. And the experimentalist behind all this is John Schmidt. So as you, in this experiment, we only excite slow shear waves. But I want to point out that slow shear waves have an angular dependence. We saw this earlier in the presentation by Simon Châtelain. You can see that the waves propagate faster along the fiber direction because the wave speed is higher in that direction. And these are results at different frequencies. Okay, these are actually the displacement maps. This is all in muscle tissue, turkey breast. This is in an aligned fibrin gel. If you polymerize fibrin gel inside a magnetic field, it'll align. And this is an isotropic material, which is just gelatin. This is the side view of our sample. Okay. What we're really interested is white matter in the brain. And the question we're trying to ask is, does white matter in the brain appear to have anisotropic properties? So we took tissue out of a pig brain. This study was done ex vivo. The sample was embedded in gelatin. The study was done at room temperature. It's about a 45 millimeter diameter sample. Here it is embedded in the gelatin, and the stinger penetrates both the brain tissue sample and the gelatin. The dominant, this contains the corpus callosum. The dominant fiber direction is left to right. Right here, I'm going to show you results from 2 slices. The brain tissue slice is at the bottom in the area of the corpus callosum, and the gelatin is right below that. So 2 things you should see. This is the gelatin. This is the white matter brain tissue. The wavelength is longer because the brain tissue is a little bit stiffer than the gelatin. And also, whereas the radially propagating waves are almost circular, or appear to be quite close to circular in the brain tissue, in the gelatin, they're visibly elliptical, not greatly, but definitely not circular. If you actually try and do an isotropic inversion on this data, in the gelatin you'll succeed and get a very homogeneous, uniform set of a picture of apparent shear modulus. In the brain tissue, you get what looks to be a directional dependence in shear modulus, and that's because the wavelength is actually longer in these regions than it is in this region. So this is also evidence of anisotropy, and it's consistent, again, with the transverse isotropic model. Summarizing the results, at the 3 different frequencies, in each case, we estimated, this is all MRE data, we estimated a higher shear modulus in the planes containing the fibers than in planes perpendicular to the fibers. It's not a great deal of anisotropy. It's on the order of 30 to 40% stiffer. And it seems to be increasing. It seems to be more anisotropic at higher frequencies, or perhaps we're better able to detect it at higher frequencies. When we do this, when we study the samples in a direct mechanical test on the benchtop, we see slight anisotropy as well, but it's a little bit harder to detect even in a benchtop test. And the differences are statistically significant, and also the increase in anisotropy with frequency is statistically significant. So just to wrap up briefly, I want to point out, again, emphasize that when you're talking about transversely isotropic materials, we're talking about differences both in shear modulus and in tensile modulus. And it makes sense. In fact, I think it's advisable to think about estimating the parameters of the compliance matrix, not the stiffness matrix, or the parameters of the compliance tensor, not the stiffness tensor. There are two types of waves that are observed, the slow or pure shear, where there's no fiber stretch involved. But it's important to note that the fast shear waves actually involve fiber stretch, so they can be used to probe tensile anisotropy. And at the end of the day, if the tissue is indeed almost incompressible or nearly incompressible, you can describe it by this compact set of parameters, baseline shear modulus, shear anisotropy, and tensile anisotropy. Again, just to thank my funding sources and students and collaborators, and I'd be very glad to answer questions.
Thanks, Phil. Are there questions?
Yes.
Neil?
Generate those deformations in the brain that you showed at the start of your talk?
Oh, okay. So go back to that. So we have a subject lie on their back in the scanner. Their head is in a cradle. There's a counterweight. The subject releases a latch. Counterweight turns their head, and it hits a stop. I think I have the accelerations, about 250 radians per second squared. That's about a sixth of what a typical soccer player experiences when heading a typical soccer ball. And so,
does it make
you feel it, but it doesn't hurt. I mean, I think this may actually be me. In fact, that's definitely me. I'm pretty sure that's me. The accelerations are comparable to the accelerations you'd feel when you go like this. Okay, my head's, you know, when I hit the ground, that's about 4G acceleration. So.
The anisotropic results you showed in the very last results slide. It was just maybe I missed it here. So, this is reconstructing a shear modulus in each direction independently, not doing the three-parameter fit?
This was actually, since we only talked about, we're only studying slow shear waves, we only looked at, so we're only inducing slow shear waves, so only shear modulus and shear anisotropy come into this. So we're actually only estimating two parameters in this study, in this particular study.
Right, okay. In this case, you can just phi and mu, is that?
Right. But actually, to estimate that, I should have gone into this. What we did was we performed these experiments, and we performed finite element simulations with various combinations of shear modulus and shear anisotropy, and we estimated the parameters that provided the best, closest approximation between experiment and simulation, or the smallest error between.
And that was global, so a homogeneous parameter distribution. Okay.
Paul, you had a question?
So I was wondering about the sample you had of the magnetically aligned fibrin filaments.
Yeah.
How big was the difference in the transverse and the longitudinal shear modulus?
Oh, that's a great question. Let me just find the. Oh, sorry. I don't have those numbers on me, but looking at it, it's going to be more than we saw in the brain. And I think it's probably on the order of 70 or 80% stiffer in one. One is about 70 or 80% stiffer than the other, so a ratio of about 1.7 or 1.8, I think.
So do you know the order parameter of the fibrin? I mean, the fibers along the bundle direction when it's aligned? Or is that something you can presumably experimentally vary?
It can be. In fact, in the original study where we first did this, we aligned our fibrin gel at two magnetic field strengths. So one was 4.7 and one was 11.7. And it's as you might expect, you get a stronger and more strongly anisotropic material when you align it at the higher field strength. It's actually not simple to, in a controlled way, vary the anisotropy, just because we're dealing with a material that's seems to want to polymerize at its own rate, and it's, so it's not as simple as you might think to control it.
Is there any microscopy technique to look at those fibers, at the alignment of the
fibrin? Yes, in the fibrin, we look at slices, actually histological slices with a confocal microscope, and you can...
You can see it.
Can see it, that's right. You can see it and quantify it.
So, Phil, nice presentation here.
Yeah.
quick question, because you said that when you excited in one direction versus the other, you have observed the fast versus slow. Did you excite both at the same time?
No, not in this case, although in simulations we have.
So what did you observe?
So there, we can't do the simple thing that I just showed in my spreadsheet, where, let's see, up here. So in this spreadsheet, I only analyzed data where it was either slow or fast. When you've got both, you have to do something like directionally filter using both polarization and propagation, so you only analyze one wave at a time. Otherwise, when you've got both things going on, it's can of worms. You've got to you can directionally filter and separate out.
But for that, we need to know the direction of the fibers, right?
That's
like
right.
What Tony did.
Exactly, and you need to, in any case where you're doing any directional filter, you do need to know the fiber direction, which you can typically get.
Mu perpendicular and mu parallel.
Yes.
Hello.
Which is mu parallel? Just to be clear, which is mu parallel and which is mu perpendicular?
Mu parallel. So I'm sorry. Mu parallel and mu perpendicular were the measurements on the dynamic shear test. We just label them differently to keep them straight. But mu one and mu two are the analogous ones. So mu one, the stiffer one, is the one where we're in the direction of the fibers. So we're shearing in the planes that contain the fibers. And mu two is the one that's where we're shearing in the plane perpendicular to the fibers.
So is mu one C44 and mu two C66, or is it the opposite?
So in your case, are the fibers aligned with the Z axis?
Yeah, so is which one has displacement perpendicular, propagation parallel?
Displacement perpendicular is mu two.
Okay.
Is it C44?
Four, yeah. And 5/5 is parallel. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
No, 6/6.
Six, six. Yes. 6/6 is perpendicular.
Yes. We should discuss afterwards.
Okay. I get confused with the notation.
Two symmetric shear modules.
Yeah.
And one perpendicular. Extraordinary shear modulus in our case. This is C66, but we can discuss this later.
Did you do anything to fix the porcine brain, or did you just cut it out and set it in the...
Yes. This is fresh porcine brain. I should have pointed out it's also within 2 hours. Our time limit was within 2 hours. And of course, we expect that the properties of the ex vivo brain are going to be slightly different than what's in the in vivo brain. And of course, that's why we're interested in MRE, so we can ultimately do it in vivo. We have DTI on this as well. It's unfortunately, the DTI is not as clean as it is ex vivo as it is in vivo, but it does show, and we're lucky in this case because we know which way the fiber direction is as well, and we know that.
Thank you.